Yeah.
Perfect. All right, let's continue. Rabbi Susie Stone has 7 or 8 written questions, and she'll look them over. And then if we have still time, we'll bring the microphone to the middle aisle for the rest. All right. Rabbi Stone.
Okay. Some of these questions I'm still trying to decipher, just because I have a hard time reading cursive. I'm not that young, but it's still sometimes it's hard. Okay, so I'm going to start with some of the easier, kind of like more technical questions. One of the questions was, do I speak Aramaic? And if so, can I say something in that language? So I definitely don't speak Aramaic, but we study Aramaic. That was a tough one. Wow. Okay, if you want to ask more questions, you can just raise your hand later, because it's too intimidating to get more questions coming up to me now. So Aramaic is... It's not a spoken language. It's really just codified in the Talmud at this point. It was definitely the Franco lingua of the time in ancient Israel. The most famous prayer that is said in Aramaic is the Kaddish. It's a memorial prayer when someone passes away. So the prayer, I could say a few words in Aramaic, which is Yitzgadal v'yitzgadash shemei rabah b'alma divrach kirtev m'lich mahute. Okay, so does that help? Means, Yitzgadal means God is great. V'yitzgadash means God is holy. It's hard for me to translate word by word. But basically the idea is God is great, God is holy, God is one. May God's name be blessed. It's a memorial prayer, but it doesn't speak about God. It doesn't speak about death and dying. It actually speaks about holiness. But again, Aramaic is a language that's studied. It's not spoken. And we do study it in rabbinical school, but nobody I know really speaks Aramaic anymore. And when you saw the Passion of Christ, that was not Aramaic, in case you were wondering. Okay, so another quick question. The Pentateuch is the first 5 books. That is correct. We would call that the Torah. Yeah, so the question was, is that the same thing as the Torah? Yeah, in Hebrew, the Pentateuch is what we call the Torah. So that is the same for us. Vect, this is my favorite question. I had to look it up too. It is not the same as kvetch, which is meaning to, kvetch is like Yiddish to complain. Vect is a small seed. It's like a... kind of, a vect is like a seed that needs to be sweetened, which was one of the quotes that I had up there. So that was a really easy question. So thank you for asking me one I could answer quickly. I love those. Oh my goodness. Could I please sing Avinu Malkeinu? Who asked that one? Quite courageous question. I don't love to sing in public because I'm a little shy. So maybe I'll come back to it, okay? I'm not a cantor. A cantor is paid to sing and they love to do it. They're performers. I'm a rabbi. I love to teach. So if I get my courage up, I will. Yeah. You mean you know it? Oh, you know it. I can do it on the side later. But okay. Okay, so one of the questions, where's the feminine in all of this? Who asked that question? Can you say a little bit more about what's behind the question or what exactly? Because that's a huge question. So I'm happy to answer, but I'd just like to know a little bit more pointed what you mean by that.
We ought to have anybody who asks a question come to the microphone or else we will never get a recording.
Okay. Well, in your presentation, I heard a lot of he, him,
yeah,
and all that. And frankly... you know, from my own background, I feel excluded, as you probably do from history and all that. So I have this idea that Judaism, in its inception, was trying to separate away from the female goddesses, the religions at the time. Hmm. So that's where the question came from.
Hmm.
that's why Adam, rather than Adam and Eve, you know,
got it.
Being created.
Yeah, it's interesting. So it's not the first time I've heard that theory. It's definitely in the 5 years that I've studied Jewish theory, history, rabbinics, it's never been a reason. It's never ever been something that I've been taught. So I think it is a popular notion, but I don't think it has any really innate Jewish origins. I think that there is, so meaning that I don't think that Judaism was trying to move away from the feminine goddess culture, therefore it became overly masculine. I actually think that because, like I said before, while we often say Adam and Eve, it's actually really a misunderstanding of the Hebrew. It's Ha-Adam, is the human being. Okay? So, and Adam HaRishon is the first human, right? And there's a beautiful midrash, it's not in the Torah, but it's a rabbinic teaching about how the first human being is very similar. If you've read Plato's Symposium, the first human beings were actually created back-to-back, male and female together. And that is the first story in Genesis. And then over time, they were separated. And then the whole idea of finding your soulmate, your besheret in Hebrew, is that you come back and you find the person that you're meant to be with. And so the first human being was actually male and female together. Okay, and that actually, like, if you've read Plato's Symposium, that actually shows up in Greek mythology as well. And so I don't actually think that Judaism was a reaction against goddess culture. The reason why I asked about the question was because the way I was going to answer this was that there's actually a very strong mystical notion in Judaism of something called the Shekhinah, the feminine notion of the feminine. It's not notion, it's aspect of God, is called the Shekhinah. And it's, again, very complicated, but we do have a pretty strong notion in Judaism, and that God has, just like we have many different roles, like we're a mother, or we're a sister, or we're a daughter, or we're a teacher, you know, we have roles, but I'm still the same Susie, right? So too does God have these different aspects, right? God can be a warrior and a lover, and God can be feminine and masculine, but it's still all one God. And so God has what is known as the Shekhinah aspect, which is the feminine aspect, and that Shekhinah is the aspect of God that is most closest to humanity. And so if you ever pray in a Jewish synagogue, on Friday nights, during one prayer, we'll turn to the back of the sanctuary, and we will bow and face the Shekhinah and welcome the feminine aspect of God into the sanctuary. And we actually bow and pretend as if the bride, feminine aspect, a bride is walking through. So God is pictured as a bride walking into our sanctuary. You know how when you stand for a bride, it's the same thing. So I would actually say there's a very positive relationship with Judaism and the feminine aspect of God. Yeah. So I'm on mysticism, so I'll stay in that. There's another question about the reference to younger Jews being attracted to mysticism, and Christians have been discovering or rediscovering mysticism. Christian mystics, sorry. Would you say more about Jewish mysticism? I would love to. Who had that question? Can you say a little bit more about, again, what aspect of Jewish mysticism do you want to know about?
No, I just, not really. Sorry. No, it's just that in this group and in other settings, in probably the last 5 years, I've heard more and read more about Christian mystics, and that's just becoming more and more of interest and focus. And so I was just intrigued by your reference to younger Jews being attracted to the mysticism in Judaism.
So do you want to know about the content of Jewish mysticism, or the more attraction to it?
Well, probably both. A little bit of what do you mean when you reference Jewish mysticism, and what about it is attracting younger people?
Okay. So it's interesting because the content is much more philosophical and theological than it is practice. There's no practice of Jewish mysticism unless you were, again, like I said, to go to the Kabbalah Center in L.A., which, by the way, when I did go there, because I studied in Los Angeles for seminary, and I was very interested to see what was happening. This is the place that, you know, Madonna popularized. And 99% of the people there were not Jewish, which is fine, by the way, I have no problem, but what I'm saying is that Kabbalah, when I say that it's being more and more popular among young Jews, it's not that there's a practice that goes along with being a mystic or a young Jewish person who is interested in Kabbalah. It's that Jews are reading about it and they're becoming more interested in the spiritual aspect of Judaism. But it's not as if there's like, okay, because I'm a Kabbalist, I do X, Y, or Z. Does that make sense? So you still have the same practice. Like you still, you know, maybe people would be, young Jews are actually, I think, kind of more going back to the land, I would say. Sort of like, there's a lot of young Jews who are kind of doing this, there are organizations now that are helping Jews I'm thinking of Jews in their 20s and 30s, kind of go to, it's called Passover in the Desert, or Shavuot, which is our, where we celebrate Revelation at Sinai, where we go to a mountain and we camp out for a few days. So, like, that's kind of how I think it's influencing young Jews, is that young Jews are becoming more spiritual and less institutionalized. So young Jews don't want to, and we were talking about this earlier, that it's a cutting across to religions, is that young people are becoming more spiritual and less wanting to relate to institutions, and that's how it's kind of playing out. And so in terms of just generally, like, what is Jewish mysticism, it's a little bit, the beginnings of it is what I explained already, which is like the idea of God contracting and making room for human beings, and that the fundamental principle is that we're partners with God, and that it's not a subservient relationship. And so I think it speaks to a lot of postmodern young people, because that's also the philosophy of the world at this moment, right? Accepting and tolerance and working together in partnership is just the vocabulary in which we live in a postmodern world. And so therefore, that kind of Kabbalistic mysticism is really attractive to young people, and it just fits with the worldview at this moment. The idea of, you know, a God on high who is, you know, kind of a divine puppet master is not fitting with the world, you know, postmodern thinking at this point for them. Oh, I have questions, sorry. Making me do all the work, okay. I love the question about Fiddler on the Roof, but the truth is I saw that when I was 5 and I've never seen it since, so I can't answer it. I need to watch it again. it's sort of like par for the course. I should know as a rabbi about that movie, but I don't. Kind of embarrassing. All right. Next time you can watch the movie, you can have a film screening. All right. So how does evolution fit into the... something... Yeah? Reform? Oh, Reform Jews' contraction theory of creation. No, I only say it because somebody else was talking to me about sort of quantum physics, and I'm not a science person, and it's hard for me to... the truth is there's, like, no conflict in Judaism and science. And so I guess maybe that's why also it's hard for me to answer those questions. But I also, I never took physics in high school because I just can't wrap my head around science that well. I can study Aramaic, but science is another thing. So it's hard for me to answer that. I mean, other than the fact that, like I said, there really isn't a contradiction and the rabbis were very forward thinking about sort of like, you know, the first day is actually 1,000 years, and the second day was another 1,000 years, and the third day. So we already have, you know, so the Torah, you know, in around the year zero, when the rabbis were writing about the creation, the story of creation, we already have this notion that day one was not one day. Okay, so you already know that the rabbis were pretty progressive for their time. And does that help? Who asked that question? Okay. I know that's really not about evolution, but does that kind of answer the question? Okay. I'm so bad with physics and quantum physics and particle theory. which somebody else talked to me about, and I really know nothing. I wish I did, but sometimes you just got to let go. And just, you know, go follow your strengths.
I'd like to know what the what your Reformed Judaism, you know, feelings are, what your congregation's feelings are about the necessity of a Jewish homeland versus, for example, something, a state of mind rather than a state, you know, a physical state. Is there any discussion of that, or is there unanimity on the absolute need for territory?
Tom, I think you asked the same question last year. Is it possible? Somebody asked a very similar question. If not you, I'm happy to answer it again. Yeah, but do you was it you or someone else? Okay. I remember because it hits home. Yeah. So, and this is how I'll answer it. It has changed throughout history how Jews feel about a Jewish homeland. In the beginning, Jews, I think, you know, the first Jewish imperative was Lech Lecha, go forth from your homeland, right? And Abraham was told to leave everything he knew and to leave his home in Haran, which was not Israel, right? And to leave everything he knew and to go away and to be a part, to go on a journey that was uncomfortable, okay? And to leave everything comfortable and to be uncomfortable. And so there are some rabbis, and I believe this as well, that teach us that in order to be a Jew is actually innately to be uncomfortable. The first imperative, the first sort of commandment is Lech Lecha, go forth from yourself, and be just to be in the uncomfortability of life. Okay, and so then we have, you know, for, you know, once we have the first Commonwealth, once we have, after many years of establishing a Jewish homeland in the state of Israel, we have the first exile and the second exile. We're kicked out twice. In 70, we have the final time that we've been kicked out by the Romans. There are many Jews who think there is literally going to be no return. Okay, and there it's interesting because once we have been kicked out in 70 and living in Babylon, there are many Jews who think this is great by the rivers of Babylon. And, I mean, it's a sad song, but truthfully, most people never left Babylon. They didn't want to go back and rebuild the temple because life was better in Babylon. We were actually treated better in Babylon than we were treated in Israel. So, similarly, what a lot of American Jews experience is that it's actually an easier life in America than it is in Israel at this point, so why would we want to go back? Okay? That's not an easy statement for me to say, but I'll say it. So, that point in history... For 2,000 years, I would say, people prayed to want to return to Israel, but I don't think anyone in our right mind ever imagined we would. I think the greatest... It's sort of incredible for me to think, and I was asked the question, I was at a conference actually just a week ago, and they asked the question, it was like a speed friending where you sit in a circle and, you know, you move around, and the question was, if you could have dinner with anybody, you know, dead or alive, who was Jewish, who would it be? And I said, it was very simple to me. It was Theodor Herzl, the founder of modern Zionism. Because he said, Im tirtzu, ein zo agada. If you dream it, it is no dream. So this man, this one man, experienced the Dreyfus Affair in France. And he basically experienced, after, you know, 100 years of Jews being liberated and having full citizenship, this man who was a full military, honored, decorated man, who was, you know, convicted of treason, of libel from the military. His name was Alfred Dreyfus, a Jew. And later on, they find out that he really wasn't guilty. But at the time, they didn't know, and he was brought into public and humiliated and basically defamed for this crime, but wasn't really actually, wasn't true. But he and the whole time it was, you know, Jew, go back to where you belong, and you know, but this was 100 years after emancipation. And so Theodor Herzl writes a book called Auto-Emancipation. He says, we've been living in Europe for 100 years, and we have been emancipated by the people who say we're equal. But until we have a homeland like everyone else, we're always going to be strangers in a strange land. And that was proven to him by the fact that 100 years after emancipation, they were still being basically brought out into the public square and hung like from the gallows. And he decided to literally from thin air start a campaign to create a Jewish homeland and to go back after 2,000 years to create a state in Israel. And so the idea of having a Jewish homeland for me is absolutely necessary for that exact reason. I think we're not past the need to have a place where Jews can always be safe. I think that there was a time in the Reform Movement where your first part of your question was true. They said, no, we're beyond that. We can have a spiritual home and we don't need a physical home. And actually, for the Reform Movement started in the 1800s in Germany. And the reason why I would argue, actually, that the Reform Movement was, they were actually anti-Zionist for a while, was because they were afraid of dual loyalties. They had just been emancipated by Germans. And they didn't want to, and this, I don't know if, how many of you know this, but I think it's fascinating. In 1789, Napoleon called a Jewish Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was the ancient Jewish court. And he brought all these rabbis together, and he, you can look it up, it's fascinating. You can see all the questions that Napoleon asked these rabbis. And so the first question was, are you loyal to France or are you loyal to Jews? And so they had to decide, who are you loyal to? And, you know, it's not, you know, I hate to say this, but, like, you know, the question underlying a lot of anti-Semitism is still a question of dual loyalties. It always has been, it always will be. And so when we talk about sort of Israel and do we need a homeland, I hate to say, and I don't want to, you know, part of me being a you know, 21st century postmodern rabbi is no identity should be built around fear. That is really important to me. But we still live in a place where dual loyalties are still an issue. And so when this Jewish Sanhedrin was called, and in the 1800s, you know, 1789 to 1800s in Germany, the German Jews in the Reform Movement said, we're not gonna support Zionism because they're going to think we're not loyal to Germany. And we just got our emancipation. We just became full citizens. So how are we going to support Israel? And so there's a, it's interesting, if you the history of Reform Judaism is actually quite interesting because for about 100 years they didn't support Israel and then we've totally changed. But I believe very strongly it's a product of history. And so at one point, Tom, your question was actually right on, that the Jews believed, the liberal Jews believed that we only needed a spiritual homeland, we didn't need a physical homeland. And then after the Holocaust, it became abundantly clear that even more so than during the Dreyfus Affair, that we needed a physical homeland. So, you know, that gets into, and I remember the question last year going on to sort of like, you know, questions of ethics in modern day Israel. And, you know, I'll be the first to say Israel is not a perfect country, you know, and, but neither is America or any other place that exists. And so I think that, you know, that should not then eliminate or sort of negate the right for any people to have a physical place of refuge.
Just a quick one about the line you quoted a moment ago about if you can dream it, it's not a dream. Do you mean it's not worthy of being a dream or it can be real?
It can be real. Yeah. And so agadah. So meaning, im tirtzu, if you will it, it is no dream. Agadah meaning, yeah, it's hard to translate. If you will it, it's no dream.
What do Jews believe for the afterlife? I mean, after we're gone here.
You got hard questions today.
I know. I thought you liked that one.
How much time do you have? I'm only saying that because I once a month I go visit Maravilla, which is where a lot of our older residents live, and we just had this conversation, but it's really complicated. In Judaism, we don't spend a lot of time. But can I ask you a clarifying question, which is it, are you asking about, like, life after death and resurrection, or are you asking about, like, the personal...
Well, when you pass over, do you go to a heaven, or is this the end of your existence?
Okay. That's helpful. Okay, great. I still don't know the answer. I got myself into a harder question. There's so many different opinions that it's hard to actually... I'm just trying to figure out what is the most authentic and nuanced way to answer the question. Yeah. Sure. Well, so it is interesting that, like, one of the things I would say is sort of a downfall in our community is that we have a really hard time talking about death and dying and what happens to us, and most Jews actually don't talk about it and are uncomfortable with it, and one of the things I actually want to do more of is to talk about it, and so that's why I do talk about it more. But and so the person who said, you know, we don't believe in it, it's sort of true, but not really. It just means that they haven't been exposed to the teachings. The one truth is that what they said is true. We have a saying called Zichrono Livracha, which means may their memory be a blessing. And so when somebody passes on, their memory becomes a part of us, and they're basically, we live out their values. And that's how 99% of Jews feel comfortable with that teaching, that sort of, right? But that doesn't necessarily mean that their lives stop there or their, right? So they're, you know, I'll go on the mystical for a minute. I'll stay with the mystical teaching. The mystical teaching has this notion that your soul is eternal, absolutely. And so while your body may no longer be, your soul is always connected, and that your soul returns to sort of this heavenly palace or court, and it's collected in a way that you're reconnected to all the souls who ever lived. And so, you know, a lot of people are like, well, I'll see my loved one afterwards, or I'll meet up with my loved one, and, you know, and often people say, well, isn't that like a Christian teaching? And I said, not really. Like, we have a very similar teaching in Judaism, and it's called Otzer HaNefeshot, which means like a collection or a treasury of souls. And it's, again, this is a very mystical teaching, so it's not the mainstream, but there is no mainstream teaching in Judaism about the afterlife. But I will say the fundamental principle is that the soul is eternal in Judaism, and while your body may no longer be, your soul is always there. And so, and there's different levels of your soul. There might be a part of your soul that there's in the mystical tradition, there's five different levels of your soul. One part of your soul does cease to exist, but the higher levels can remain and continue on. And while I feel very not convinced of this part, but there are some mystics who believe that even your soul then transmigrates into somebody else. And there's a very small minority of people. And I would say I don't actually know anyone in practice who believes this, but it's written in the Zohar, which is the mystical tradition, that, you know, there is such thing as reincarnation. But again, I don't know anyone in Judaism who believes in it. I just know that it is written in the 15th century in our tradition. But again, I've never met any Jew who believes in reincarnation. Well, personally, I know there are people, but I just haven't met them. Yeah. Yes, go ahead.
So we were privileged to have the author speak to us, and one story he told really stuck with me to the point you were just asked to speak to. And he was at a conference, and he was talking to a older rabbi, and mm-hmm. Samir was wrestling with this issue of being good on earth and for being rewarded later. And he said, well, what in Judaism? What do you think about it? And he said, the rabbi sat there, stroked his beard, and said, one world at a time, my son.
Right. Well, right. It's beautiful. And there is a teaching in the Mishnah that says, you know, 1 hour of good deeds in this world is better than a lifetime in eternity. So when people ask, like, what's going to happen in the world to come, that's usually what I tell them. We are just this worldly focus. It's just that's the nature of this religion. Yeah.
Well, as I recall, there was an ancient teaching, or maybe just tradition, that there were seven levels to heaven. And that is where our concept of being in seventh heaven comes from, being the highest of the levels.
It sounds familiar, but I actually don't know where that teaching comes from. I can't say yes or no because I'm not sure.
I became interested in it because in one of the letters of Paul in our New Testament, he talked about having reached the third heaven.
Uh-huh.
So I began to look that up to see where that idea came from. And it came up that it didn't say exactly where, but that it was an ancient belief that there were seven levels to heaven.
Yeah.
And in the Judaic tradition.
Yeah, it's echoing, but I would have to look it up myself.
And also, when you go way back in history, you find that that heaven was down underneath the ground in Sheol.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't exactly heaven, but it was a place. It wasn't heaven at all, as a matter of fact. But it was a place where everyone went after they died.
Yeah, it's not clear in the Torah what Sheol really is. It's definitely not hell, and it's definitely not heaven.
No, it isn't.
It's
sort of a Greek concept. It's like Hades, where everybody went.
Yeah, I don't know enough about Hades to know if Sheol is the same. But Sheol in the Torah is really kind of this like. It's not described enough for us to know. We know that a lot of the patriarchs went there.
Saul called Samuel up out of it at one point.
Right.
Samuel was rather grumpy about it.
Right. I'm thinking of Jacob when he finds out that Joseph, is lost and no longer. He says, I will never, I will always be down in Sheol. And so it definitely isn't necessarily a positive place, but it's also described kind of neutrally. But we know that it's not like a fiery furnace. We know that.
But they definitely believed that you did not disappear after you died.
What do you mean by?
I mean you were not gone. You went someplace. You still preserved your who you were, your identity.
Yeah.
But still, it wasn't very clear then, and I guess
it's definitely not clear. No, there's a book called if you want to learn more. I think one of the best books on this is called "Does the Jewish Soul Survive?" And Elie Spitz is the author. You might want another book series for you guys. And he talks about this a lot. And one of the things he says is that a lot of times, if you look at the Hebrew scriptures, it says. He died, he was buried, and he was gathered to his fathers. And he says, well, it's not about burial, and it's not about dying. The gathering to the fathers must be that he was somehow memorialized and somehow became kind of connected back to his family. So that's where I got that other sentiment that I gave you earlier. I think we have time for, one more question. Or two more questions. We can do two more. We have enough time to do two more.
I think of the words, the last words of the 23rd Psalm,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not sure when that was written. Do you know?
I don't know the exact date.
It says, even though I walk through the valley of death, I will fear no evil because thou art with me.
Yeah.
And I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever.
Sure.
That sounds like a belief in an afterlife. Mm-hmm. I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever.
Oh, so it's so interesting how... Do you guys use this at funerals? Okay. So yeah, we use this at funerals. And you're right. If in the context of a funeral, it does sort of seem like an afterlife concept. But we also use it during the high holidays around Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And the idea of the house of God is really sort of is dwelling in God's presence or the Shekhinah, going back to the feminine aspect. And so I actually have no connection with afterlife when I hear that psalm. I think about being in closeness with God, but not necessarily... about an afterlife, and it could just be a personal thing, but I'll have to go back and think about that more.
Rabbi Susie, one thing, our book series had to do with basically various religions. So you're starting and creating an interfaith group for young people. I'd be interested to hear how it's going. Can you fill us in?
Sure. Yeah, like I said, this is one of the most exciting things I'm doing this year. We started in August, and it came up actually because just about a year and a half ago, I was having Passover at a friend's house, and it happened to be that she had been doing some interfaith work with the Muslim community, and was sitting across from some young Muslims, and I thought, well, there's a lot of interfaith opportunities in Santa Barbara, but not a lot of them include like specifically young adults. And it was just really nice to be able to talk to peers and just to be able to kind of like think about what is the next generation of religious leadership in this community and how to kind of develop that. And so it took not very long for us to get off the ground. It was April, and then by August we had our first meeting. And it's so cool. We have about 25 to 30 young adults who meet once a month. It's about 10, 10, and 10, which is really nice. And I just took suggestions. I was like, there's so many churches in town. Where should I go? And we had a standing relationship with Trinity Episcopal for other projects. And so my senior rabbi suggested to go to that church. And they were happy to be working with us. And so we meet again once a month, and we rotate whether it's at the synagogue or the church, and they don't have a mosque yet, but they're working on it. And so we meet at UCSB or community center. And so far we've literally just been kind of doing kind of like one-on-one sessions and sort of like, what is Judaism, what is Islam, what is Christianity? We've just now moving to more topic-oriented, so we did like economic justice from each lens, which is how my goal is at. And now we're going to be moving on to like, again, more focused topics, and where each host gets to decide which topic and they moderate the discussion. But it's been, like I said, really, really rewarding. And my goal would be to somehow replicate it and to have, you know, many of these happening throughout the city and to sort of like put it to scale. And I don't know how to do that yet because I'm only one person, but that would be my goal, to do that in many different ways. But it's just, I think what's been so fun out of this is, and I'm sure you guys know who work and have done interfaith dialogue before, is the relationships are just what is so neat. It's, you know, the dialogue is great, but, you know, we went out to eat afterwards and you develop friends. And, you know, one of the things that we went out to the IHOP after this last one, and fine dining. And, but, you know, one of the things that struck me was that what happened in North Carolina with these three Muslim students, you know, could have been Santa Barbara. And, you know, what's been happening in Europe with the synagogues could have been here. And I said to myself, you know, thank God we're doing this. Thank God we're developing relationships. And, you know, I know that coming here and speaking, I hope we'll develop those relationships too. But it's really the intimate, you know, really monthly contact, I think, that develops the trust, that develops the deeper relationships, so that God forbid anything were to happen to in our community, we would be there for each other. And it's such a tragedy what's happening in our country, in our world right now, and people targeting other people of faith. And so I think that that's really why I say that's the most important thing I'm doing right now. It really is the most important thing I'm doing. So I really do want to thank you for inviting me back, and I'm happy to come anytime, and I really do learn a lot from being here.